Again, he was silent. Sherry. Connor, what was it for? Bailey came up and nudged my hand to pet his face. I sat down on the bed. Connor, I didn't want to tell you. Sherry, tell me what? You're scaring me. Connor, when you were away, I called a woman. Sherry, what? A woman? Who? The blood drained from my body and my heart went cold. I couldn't think clearly. I felt like running. Connor got up and walked over to me. I remember him saying, I'm sorry, Sherry. He could barely get the words out of his mouth. His voice screeched as he wept. I keep hurting you. I had absolutely no feeling. Connor had been looking at porn and making sex calls for the past 4 years. He sobbed uncontrollably, and I didn't care. His tears meant nothing to me. I'd seen them before, the other times he'd been caught. My heart was aloof, apathetic, and dead. I braced myself for what I didn't want to know. Connor, I hired a woman for... His words stopped. Sherry, what? Connor, for what? Connor, sexual favors. Sherry, a prostitute? Sexual favors? Why are you doing this to me? When you hired the prostitute, did you think about me? Days later, I gathered the courage to ask Connor what happened. I was mad. I wanted to know where Connor put me from the time he went to the ATM to get the $200 and went to see the prostitute. It's not uncommon for wives to ask their husbands, where did I go when you were sexually acting out? When did you stop thinking about me? Our children? Our marriage? Questions like these ran through my mind. Did you think about me when you were driving to the bank? When you got cash at the ATM? Was I in your thoughts then? When you met with a prostitute, where did I go in your mind? Answer to these questions are often and surprisingly, no, I didn't think about you. In some twisted and distorted way that doesn't make much sense, I'm glad Connor didn't think about me when he was with her. It's as if I was in a shoebox on a shelf far out of sight. Truthfully, I didn't want to see what happened. I couldn't stand it if I did. What's in my mind's eye is more than enough. It's not denial. I know what happened, and I don't want anything to do with her. It's my own holocaust, a nightmare I couldn't wake up from. So where did I go in that moment? That shoebox had a name, compartmentalization. It's a term used in the addiction world to describe when someone unplugs from their reality and conscience and steps into their own grave of sexual fantasy. The woman named Folly is brash. She is ignorant and doesn't know it. Come in with me, she urges the simple. To those who lack good judgment, she says, stolen water is refreshing. Food eaten in secret tastes the best. But little do they know that the dead are there. Her guests are in the depths of the grave. Proverbs chapter 9, verses 13, 16 through 18. Peeling back the layers of sex addiction. I never thought this could happen. I thought he treasured what I brought into our relationship, and I meant more. That's what hurt the most. How could I lovingly pack his lunch every day, ride bikes with him to our favorite restaurant, laugh with him, and lie next to him in bed, only to be deceived again? The word addiction comes from the Latin phrase meaning to be enslaved by or bound to. Likewise, the ancient Hebrew word picture for lust, eva, means a strong nail that binds you to itself. It's amazing how these two cultures have such similar views. Here are three common predictors found in addiction. 1. An ongoing obsession and craving for the object of the addiction. 2. Loss of control in spite of well-meaning attempts to stop. 3. Continued involvement with the drug of their choice, regardless of negative consequences, with physical health, finances, shattered relationships, or problems with the law. Sexual betrayal takes on many forms, including emotional affairs, sexual affairs, pornography, sexting, cybersex, topless bars, massage parlors, strip clubs, prostitutes, illegal sexual behavior, hard porn, child porn, random hookups, same-sex acts, date rape, voyeurism, fetishes, and sex with animals. Carl Jung, one of the most influential psychiatrists of all time, said, "People will do anything, no matter how absurd, to avoid facing their own souls." Emotional triggers and trauma. Life hurts and relationships are complicated. Many men who are sexually compulsive have post-traumatic stress from the impact of early emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. Add decades of shame from self-medicating with porn and illicit sex acts, and it's no wonder PTSD is connected to all types of addictions. These men use sex to deal with their unwanted feelings. Because most men don't wear their pain on their sleeves, their internal chaos is often deadened by silence, anger, control, or success. They stay defensive and disconnected from those closest to them. The constant fear of being caught in their own cycles of sexual deception keep men buried in shame. "I'm a fraud. I'm unwanted. I can't trust anyone. I can't trust myself. I'm weak and inadequate. I'm a bad and worthless person. I'm shameful and don't deserve forgiveness. No one loves me as I am, especially if you knew me. No one can meet my needs, so I'll take matters into my own hands." So why would anyone get on this sexually compulsive detour? They are under the influence of three things: fear, dread, and an addicted brain. 1. They often have a fear of intimacy. 2. They dread feelings. When emotions are triggered, they hit a panic button and sexually act out instead of dealing with uncomfortable thoughts or feelings that need to be faced. 3. Their brain gets hooked on neurochemicals like dopamine and endorphins, the feel-good chemicals, adrenaline, which gives them a rush, oxytocin, which bonds them to porn, and serotonin, which helps them relax. Simply put, in the book, The Porn Trap, the more orgasms you have with porn, the more sexually and emotionally attached to it you'll become. As we will see with Kevin in Chapter 10, many men have underlying brain chemistry issues that are either untreated or misdiagnosed. Things like depression, general anxiety, bipolar disorder, some type of ADD, post-traumatic stress, obsessive-compulsive disorder, or sleep apnea. Some spouses try to self-medicate their mood disorders with alcohol, sex, drugs, tobacco, or marijuana. The sex addict and their brain repeatedly jump onto the dopamine fast track as a way of avoiding long-term issues of the heart. Attunement, attachment, and availability. Recent research has shown a connection between the brain, attachment, and trauma. When considering how painful events impact the brain, researchers have found that people need three things from their parents in order for their brains to work properly. 1. Attunement. They felt comfort. 2. Attachment. They bonded with a parent. 3, availability. Their parents gave them the presence and time. Men who've grown up without these things have difficulties managing their emotions and relationships. These men not only struggle to know their own hearts, but also struggle in knowing how to bring their hearts to women. By the time I was 7 years old, I already had walled off my heart. My dad didn't see me. He was too busy watching TV or working on his car. He wasn't impressed with my Hot Wheels, even though he gave them to me. Once my neighbor friend showed me porn, I felt better. My dad is a respected executive who traveled the world. Growing up, I got everything a young boy could want. When he came home from some exotic land, he'd bring me presents. What I didn't get was his presence, P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E. I grew up watching Batman. I created a Batmobile to protect myself from my mother's rage. When my mom would scream, I'd imagine the bulletproof windows closing up around me. I tuned her out. Today, I use the same tactic with my wife. Many of us have trouble maintaining relationships with other people. But I don't think it's possible to treat a sexual disorder without looking at the underlying problems with emotional regulation and a fear of intimacy. The Latin word for intimacy is intimus, meaning innermost. Letting someone into this space means authentically revealing your most private, vulnerable self to another. And in return, the other reveals themselves to you. It's exciting and sometimes scary and requires we trust each other. Most men struggling with sexual integrity issues don't know what they feel or how to share that deeply. Generally, they struggle with these three things. 1, how close they get to others. 2, how well they know themselves. And 3, their ability to feel and manage emotions. They will tell you what they think or share opinions, but when it comes to issues of the heart, they get stuck. They might ignore or avoid their feelings. Most have grown up in families where childhood neglect, not getting what they needed, and abuse, experiencing things that shouldn't happen to anyone, were alive and well. Parents said things like, "Stop being a baby. I'll give you something to cry about. Soldier up." Or, "Real men don't cry," discouraging them from experiencing their emotions. Often these men were neglected, unsafe, and not emotionally felt. Because of this, they don't know how to offer empathy, give comfort, or emotionally feel someone else. The word empathy comes from the German word Einfühlung, which means feeling into. Healthy connections develop mirror neurons in the brain. That's how someone feels another person's emotions. When these mirror neurons aren't developed, people struggle to pick up on emotional cues or implicitly know what's going on with someone. Cognitive empathy grows when someone learns how to understand others by listening to their perspective, thinking about what's been said, and then learning how to attach words and emotions to it. Men hate feeling clumsy when they're not good at something, so they put themselves in non-relational settings to manage their emotions and moods. They bury their feelings of hurt, fear, joy, or sadness and mock the idea of building real relationships with other men. Many withdraw or become anxious at the thought of even trying. Pornography and cybersex become artificial ways of trying to get what they're looking for. Belonging and acceptance. Men in sexual addiction recovery groups often talk about what they're looking for in a hit. They'll say with porn, it's not the body parts that bring them back to a particular porn site. It's the facial expressions of women on the page. It's the look of longing and desire. I need you. I want you. You matter to me. You're important and valuable. It's often something they miss from a parent while growing up. They need to connect with something or someone who wants them, even though it's an illusion and short-lived. Sex addiction isn't relational, it's artificial. It becomes an obsession that no amount of gloss or fresh flesh can fulfill. They find themselves hooked into an underworld of deceptive sex acts while falling deeper and deeper into shame. Feed me, feed me. The brain is a hungry consumer with an insatiable appetite. Its reward center has one goal in mind: pleasuring our senses with decadent objects, one fast fix at a time. It might be a chocolate truffle, a sexual encounter, or a satisfying six-course meal. Science has discovered that masturbating to porn releases large doses of brain chemicals that have the addictive power of cocaine. The brain becomes hijacked. Unlike with drugs, the sex addict's high comes from the chemicals inside his own brain. The brain tells the body, "Let's do it again." For years, most people have looked at sex addiction as a moral failure or lack of self-discipline. But science provides strong evidence that porn addiction actually changes the brain. A whole new operating system emerges that convinces the brain it needs the drug of choice to survive. Sex addiction is not merely a series of poor choices. Science is showing us how it becomes a biological problem when a brain craves an increasing number of sexual risks to get the same high, and our husbands choose to keep feeding it. The problem isn't below the belt. So why is enough never enough? Like a seesaw in a schoolyard, the brain has a system of checks and balances to keep the body working well. Nerve cells in the brain use steady amounts of dopamine to promote a positive mood, motivation, energy, and pleasure. But too much of a good thing throws the brain out of whack. As the feelings of euphoria go up, the feelings of satisfaction go down. In Gary Wilson's TED Talk, The Great Porn Experiment, he describes what happens to a brain saturated by porn. He shows how abuses of online pornography make it difficult for men to maintain a healthy and satisfying relationship. Look at how Wilson describes the differences. Real connection looks like communication, eye-to-eye gaze, courtship, listening, touching, smells, pheromones, emotional support, and sexual attraction. Where arousal addiction looks like alone, voyeurism, clicking, searching, multiple tabs, shock and surprise, constant novelty, emotional disconnection, and sexual objectification. The overuse of porn can lead a man into a crisis that every man dreads: erectile dysfunction, ED. When a man's brain is drowning in dopamine, he can experience problems with sexual arousal, delayed ejaculation, or porn-induced erectile dysfunction. Men often experience loss of attraction to a real woman, sexual intensity preferred over emotional intimacy, lack of excitement, no eye-to-eye gaze, or being distracted during sex, the need for more extreme, unusual, or violent porn for arousal. Denny said, "I didn't know what was wrong with me, so I spent a couple hours looking at porn before crawling into bed with my wife. It wasn't a big deal until I couldn't perform like I used to. I felt so embarrassed. Could this be from the porn?" When a man's sexual problems increase, so does his awareness about pornography and compulsive masturbation. Support groups are popping up across the nation for men who have erectile dysfunction and are rebooting their brains by stopping the pornography use. The cycle of sex addiction. All addictions follow a cyclical pattern that takes the addict from one stage to the next. While there are a number of addiction cycles to choose from, I've pooled material from Dr. Patrick Carnes and other experts in the field to present the simplicity of the following model. So imagine a picture of a pinwheel where the cycle of addiction is in the center, and it typically starts with triggers. Triggers are pressures prompted by boredom, sexual frustration, loneliness, or stress that cause either good or bad feelings, physical uneasiness, or pain. A sex addict tries to hold those feelings down, but there's too much pain inside. He doesn't like dealing with his feelings, so he looks for a way to get quick relief. He either numbs out or medicates. Fantasy. This is the illusion of escape. He remembers how much enjoyment he had in prior sexual escapes and begins to obsess about how to get it. Obsessing. The addict loves the high he gets merely from anticipation. He goes into autopilot and uses tunnel vision to see what he wants to see. Cybersex, his favorite porn sites, or real people. Then he chases the thrill. Acting out. The sex addict finds release from his emotional discomfort through sex acts and orgasms followed by their feel-good neurochemicals, dopamine, oxytocin, and serotonin. Numbing. After acting out, the sex addict tries to push away from what just happened again. He blames, makes light of, and gives reasons for what he did as he tries to distance himself from the shame that always follows. Despair, which can be made up of shame, blame, anger, or guilt. Numbing doesn't last, and the addict's conscience comes back online. He starts to feel deeply ashamed, remorseful, and powerless over what he's done. I'll do better. Well-intentioned promises, perceived repentance, and apologies bring about a recommitment to do better, which temporarily stops behaviors. I've got this. The sex addict believes he's doing great and he's got this handled. Humility falls by the wayside. He doesn't need to rely on others to recover. That is, until a trigger catches him by surprise and without accountability and support, he chooses to use. Negative beliefs and emotions. Shame beliefs and emotions set in, causing depression, anxiety, and anger. These negative beliefs and emotions trigger the cycle of sex addiction once again. Recovery and sobriety aren't the same thing. Recovery is working on a process to deal with unwanted sexual behavior, while sobriety is the number of days from the last time an addict sexually acted out. If someone is denying, deceiving, and offending, most likely they are not sober. As wives, it's tough to find the balance between observing what's happening in our husband's recovery and working out our own healing as we walk through the betrayal process. This could be setting boundaries, dealing with our losses, and trauma triggers. Honestly, for most of us, it's hard to understand why a man sexually betrays, in spite of the consequences. There is help if he's willing to do the hard work, but it's his work to do. These interventions can be steps aimed at helping him heal. Sexual sobriety, emotional regulation, strategies for dealing with triggers, deep trauma work for his post-traumatic stress, intimacy, spirituality, and empathy development, brain-focused treatments like EMDR, brainwave optimization, or neurobiofeedback, ongoing face-to-face 12-step recovery that specifically addresses sexual compulsivity, and rigorous honesty. As men experience safety and connection with other men, they often begin to uncover their own hearts. Our souls are designed to live in truth and light. Our relationships with our husbands can change as they take one day at a time while making their recovery a priority. Chapter 9. How He Can Help You Heal. Change and restoration as a couple are possible. When a man embarks on a sexual recovery path, it's not just for him, it's for his wife's sake as well. Most men know they've caused their wives pain. They see the hurt on their faces, notice their withdrawal, and want the damage to quickly go away. How men move through their sexual infidelity is a whole different issue and generally falls into three categories. One, those who get it, men who are willing to recover. Two, those who don't get it, men who are in denial. Three, those who don't want to get it, men who have no desire to change. They are aware of what they're doing and want to keep their wives and their reputations comfortably intact while they sexually act out. Consequences often bring the motivation needed to do the hard work. Watching what your husband does over time, with your clear request for recovery and boundaries, will shed light on which category he's in. Most of our husbands didn't grow up in homes where intimacy and connection were modeled. It's not about your husband's level of intelligence, work ethic, or desire to repair his breach of trust. It's about not knowing. It's like not knowing how to land an airplane or do brain surgery. He struggles to give you the comfort and emotional connection you need because he's never experienced them. He doesn't know what to do with your emotions about his betrayal. He's thrown a grenade into the foxhole with you and your children in it. Your heart's hemorrhaging and you've pulled away for self-protection. He doesn't understand why you don't want to hug him or hold his hand. He spirals into his own shame and is focused on your rejection while you're looking for safety and assurance. He gets stuck in knowing how to bridge the gap between hurting you and helping you heal. For him, it feels like an impossible divide. The shame about what he's done makes him want to hide. When they think about facing the pain they have caused, some men panic. Others blame, while some move into becoming the victim. Many unplug and move into self-hatred. Even though your husband may not initially say that he is responsible, more often than not, he's running away from shame. Getting into a 12-step recovery process focused on sexual integrity issues can help him begin a fearless moral inventory of how he's harmed you and others to help him make amends. In the early stages of his recovery, nothing he does feels adequate enough. Our husbands get triggered by overwhelming emotions and don't know what to do with their own feelings, much less our pain. What's wrong with Corey? It's been 12 months now and he's still not getting it. He doesn't talk to me when he gets home from work, and he goes right to his office. I'm scared he's looking at porn again. Is he ever going to hear me? Casey. Corey's mom died when he was 2. His hard-working father raised him alone until he was 10. Corey didn't learn how to feel. It didn't seem like a problem until his dad got remarried to a woman with 3 teenage girls. You can imagine how quiet the home was before everything changed. Isolation turned into chaos, and Corey learned how to retreat into a world of his own. Not much has changed since then. It's still about you. For the most part, this audiobook has been about you, the woman who has experienced the pain of sexual betrayal. We walk our path one step at a time, along with a bucket load of grief and tears. But what about your husband? You and I are walking through this together, but he hasn't joined us. So what are some ideas or practical tools that have helped couples get through this pain? How can you understand his process of recovery and know how to better communicate how he can help you heal? Before I bring a couple of thoughts I've offered to men, I wanted to share a few things to consider. One, you each have your own journey. You're working on your own healing, and he needs to walk his own recovery path. He needs to want to heal for his sake. Two, if he's willing to take ownership and grow, you will see that and can acknowledge it. Three, if he's not willing to take ownership for his sobriety, you can't make it happen. I often ask women in this situation, what does it mean to you if he's unwilling to own his sobriety? Four, for the most part, when we tell a man he's doing something wrong, it makes him not want to do it. Sometimes knowledge isn't the issue. Healing comes when he's open to knowledge and it seeps into his heart. Five, you can't change him, but you can invite and influence him. You could say something like, I really want to find a healing path out of this whole thing. Since neither of us are experts, would you be willing to meet with someone who knows more than we do? Or would you be willing to look at a few ideas I read in a book that I think might help? Six, there are no guarantees. None of these ideas or some of these ideas may prove to be helpful with your guy. And then there's hope. Is he a mechanic or a medic? I'm often asked to speak with men at their sex addiction recovery groups, SA and SAA, on how they can help their wives or significant others heal. I show them two pictures. One photo is of a military medic holding a portable IV. He has one goal in mind, to bring that soldier home alive. The medic withstands the toughest conditions, bullets flying, bomb threats, and military combat on foot. He's on the ground, face to face with the wounded. Medics know the only thing a critically injured person wants to hear is, help is on the way. They're on the front line providing care to those in need. The other photo is of a mechanic. Whether he's leaning over a car engine or crammed underneath a kitchen sink, he's intent on one thing, fixing the object with the problem. Sometimes your wounds feel like the objects your husband can't fix. He'll say things like, stop it, or get over it, or deal with it. It's not long before he realizes those fix-it phrases don't work. Even though his sexual deception caused your pain, he doesn't like feeling his feelings about your feelings. He just wants your pain to stop. The painful truth is, our husbands can't heal us. We have to actively do our own trauma recovery work in order to get better. But what they can do is own what they've done and patiently walk beside us while we heal. We're looking for evidence to show they get it. We need to see they recognize how their sexual deception hurts us. We want them to acknowledge our pain. Empathize with our hurt. Stop lying and be honest with us. Feel pain and remorse over what we've lost. Take ownership by getting help and accountability when they sexually act out or relapse in recovery. We're scared. The porn, infidelity, and sex addiction have caused a great divide and taken them away from us. We want 100% guarantee that our husbands won't hurt us again. We know it's impossible, but we want it anyway. It's about securing safety for ourselves and our families. Rebuilding trust over time is what helps us heal. By nature, men are providers, protectors, and fixers. When our husbands start trying to clean up their mess, they often feel their shame and may fear losing us, so they go into fix-it mode. They vacillate between being the victim and the villain of their own story. As they start to move further into honest recovery, their humility grows. They realize how they've hurt us and begin to work on repairing the relationship. At that point, they're better able to own what they've done. As your husband is trying to figure out what to do with your pain, consider these steps that I commonly share with men in their 12-step recovery groups to help them know how to support you like a medic while you heal. So I want you to imagine a graph that says the mechanic versus the medic. On one side, the mechanic is the one that tries to fix the problem quickly. On the other is the medic who offers protection and support. Here's some of the things that you might hear if you're listening to both sides. The mechanic fails to hear her pain and wonders if listening to her hurt will somehow make the problem bigger. Where the medic listens to how she's been hurt to help her resolve the pain and to put both partners in a better place. The mechanic tells her to hurry up and heal, where the medic understands betrayal wounds take time to heal. The mechanic avoids your pain, hoping it will go away over time. The medic acknowledges her pain and says, "What do you need from me?" The mechanic tells her to stop feeling what she's feeling, tries to fix the problem by putting it on her. The medic validates her pain by acknowledging what has been done. He says, "I know I've hurt you and caused you pain." The mechanic belittles or blames her when she's triggered by an experience that reminds her of the sexual deception. The medic listens to what's been triggered, asks her, "What are you afraid of?" Honors the origin of her pain. The mechanic is dishonest, gives half-truths, or covers up sexual betrayals, which re-traumatizes her and takes the efforts to repair her back to square one. The medic believes honesty is the best policy. He applies the 48-hour rule by reaching out to process a compromise in sobriety with his sponsor or recovery group, and then discloses to his partner. The mechanic pulls away, isolates, or is unavailable during this difficult season of pain. If you begin feeling emotionally overwhelmed as you talk, the mechanic can ask for a brief break to gather his thoughts. The medic checks in with her during the day, asks about her heart, attends SA meetings, assists around the house, and attends couples therapy to show he's committed to connection, repair, and recovery. The mechanic justifies, minimizes, or denies what's happened to keep the relationship distant. Remember that humility and vulnerability will help pave the way for conversation. The medic owns what he is and is not responsible for. He might say, "I can see that you're still hurting from what I've done. I own that. I want to assure you that I did not do," and then he fills in the blank. "I hope to repair your trust and understand it will take time." The mechanic believes he needs to be the expert and tries to fix things himself. Where the medic reaches out for assistance from his sponsor or SA group to help himself stay out of the addiction cycle. Some couples choose to set up a 48-hour rule in advance as a truth-building step in case there is a break in his sobriety. The idea is your husband has 48 hours to first, contact his sponsor or men in his recovery group. Second, come clean and reestablish his sobriety plan. And then bring the reset of his sobriety date to you. If your husband isn't committed to restoring trust or is still in denial about how his sexual integrity issues have impacted you, He's not ready to use these steps. This is meant to be a tool for when he's open and asking for help and knowing what to do as the medic. If your husband is working on his recovery and showing up to repair with you, honoring his efforts to preserve his sobriety over time gives him the encouragement he needs to keep going. Recovery is not about maintaining a perfect path. When you don't acknowledge his sincere efforts to stay sexually sober, he may lose faith in what he's fighting for. Restoring his integrity and respect with you is his reward. Yes, men must do the work for themselves, but they are also fighting for us. I see well-meaning medics lose heart and give up when their wives stay painfully stuck in the betrayal-induced wounds. This is not a judgment on what you've been through or where you are today. It's an appeal to heal. When we don't get help for our trauma wounds and think they will somehow just go away over time, we stay stuck. Our healing never comes, and somehow we think our husbands can work the pain off for us. That might seem like an interesting idea, but as we know, that's not how it works. Ryan's sex addiction jacked me up. My chest felt heavy no matter what he did. One night, I had a dream that Ryan was on his belly crawling out of a black hole. I was surprised when I saw myself sitting on his back. It was everything he could do to use his elbows and drag his body forward. When I journaled about it later, I realized I was afraid to encourage him. I didn't want to cheapen how he's hurt me or give him a pass on working as hard as he needs to. I felt like if I gave him an inch, he'd take a mile. I just couldn't afford that. I guess it was my way of trying to ensure he wouldn't go back to the porn or affairs. Ryan's been sober for 2 years. When I told him about my dream and thanked him for working so hard, he started to cry. I've never seen him do that before. In some weird way, it's brought us closer. Rebecca. Recognizing your husband's efforts to repair the breach of trust goes a long way in helping both of you heal. The tortoise and the hare. The timing of recovery is very different for the betraying spouse and his partner. Most often, the sex addict has started his recovery process several months before his partner knows the full extent of what's been going on. He's been regularly attending his 12-step sex addiction recovery group, seeing a therapist, working toward preparing a full disclosure, and meeting face-to-face with a sponsor to unload the shame over what he's done. You may only know about the discoveries you've found or what he's confessed to you. Women often find out more at the full disclosure, so naturally your recovery can be a year or so behind his. A husband often has an expectation that you need to quickly catch up with him. He's feeling relief, so why can't you? Again, an interesting idea, but it's not realistic. Sexual infidelity runs deep. We're trying to catch our breath, grieve, set boundaries, and work through our triggers. We take steps backward when we discover ongoing lies or choices our husband made that compromise their sobriety. At any given time, we might be fighting for our marriage or battling through feelings of anxiety, anger, grief, disillusionment, or despair. We get tired. It's normal to vacillate between wanting to stay and wanting to go. It's not a race. It's more like climbing Mount Everest. Husbands can work at staying humble and patient while we heal. We have our own process of healing to go through, and that process takes time. Listening like Sherlock Holmes. The famous detective, Sherlock Holmes, was a keen observer who built his reputation on keeping his eyes wide open, taking in details and listening for the heart of the matter, even in the most complex situations. As we'll see in this following example, Lisa got triggered. If we listen to learn, we can get curious about what just happened in order to talk through painful triggers and events. Lisa reached out to me for help. Nate, her husband, had been working to rebuild trust after she discovered his affair. While traveling on business, Nate texted, "Hey, Lisa, send me a photo. I'm missing you." Lisa snapped a photo of her smiling face and sent it on its way. Nate texted back, "Nice photo, but that's not the type of photo I'm looking for." Lisa felt her heart clench in her chest. His request took her back to when she found sexual photos Nate had texted to another woman. She responded, "Nate, I'm not comfortable doing that. Is there something going on that I should be worried about?" He said, "Lisa, it's been 5 years. Are you ever going to move past this, or are you going to keep bringing this up?" In that moment, Nate was confronted by a shame pop-up over his affair. He felt defensive and tried pushing his bad feelings away by putting the problem on her. He was trying to fix Lisa's trigger rather than exploring what just happened. It's easy to do. Both shame and fear cause us to react rather than respond. Lisa needed Nate to get curious like Sherlock Holmes to understand how she got triggered in the first place. She needed him to understand that sexting a photo made her feel objectified and cheapened into a mere body part. While Lisa and Nate had spent several years working to restore their sexual relationship, this way of connecting reminded her of his affair. Remember that the word atone means to repair an injury and work towards restoring the wrong that's been done. In listening to how Lisa was triggered, Nate could take a deeper step toward repairing an earlier betrayal injury. Together, as a couple, they used these 3 steps to help them get out of a tight spot as they listened to learn. Number 1, stay curious. Ask thoughtful questions to further clarify your spouse's experience. What was that like for you? How did it make you feel? How long have you been feeling that way? Is there more you'd like to tell me? What can I do that would help you feel safe? 2, stay out of the penalty box. Listening to learn requires that we set aside our reasons for doing what we did so we can hear the other person's perspective. It's natural to want to defend and list the whys. When we experience shame over what we've done, it makes us want to disappear or push back even more. Husbands can get triggered by our feelings about how their betrayal hurt us. It's their shame. Before you know it, the conversation becomes about them as they spiral down a dark sinkhole of shame and we feel missed again. Working to stay out of our own shame spiral keeps us in the game and listening to the perspective of the wounded party. While most of us do it from time to time, when we defend or spiral into shame, it shortcuts the conversation. I have a whiteboard in my office where I've drawn a penalty box, just like the ones you see in a hockey game. Listening to learn is about engaging in a conversation, even when we don't agree with the other person's experience or point of view. This process is about listening to understand. It's not about fixing, correcting, shaming, defending, judging, or reacting to what's being said. These are the penalty box items. It's about suspending our perspective for a time so we can listen well and try to understand where the other person is coming from. We can't build empathy without that. 3, give yourself room to grow. Your husband may be starting to work on his fear of intimacy, feeling his emotions and seeing your heart, empathy, and emotional attunement, muscles he might have never used before. He is navigating through his own sexual shame while trying to repair his relationship with you. Even under the best circumstances, tough conversations can be challenging. One of the best tools for learning how to have difficult conversations is called the Comfort Circle from the book How We Love Workbook by Mylan and Kay Yurkovich. If you get stuck or need support, reach out to a counselor for help. Take one day and one conversation at a time. Your husband's willingness to take risks by pressing through his uncomfortable feelings is an important part of how he can help you heal. Staying out of conversational gridlocks and impasses is a key to building intimacy. It's okay to admit when you're stuck and say something like, "I really don't know how to talk about my feelings or share how I've hurt you. I didn't grow up knowing how to do this. I may need to ask for your help from time to time. Is that okay with you?" Believe it or not, this is what intimacy sounds like. It's being honest about right where you are in the present moment. It's taking a chance at something you're not good at. It's facing your fear about being imperfect. It's being real. Part 3. How betrayal trauma impacts your brain, mind, body, spirit, and sexuality. Chapter 10. When a diamond's not a girl's best friend. "I can't do this anymore. Kevin's not coming home." Crystal saw Kevin's car parked when she drove past his office. She was worried. It was 3 a.m. and the lights were still on. What was he doing at that hour anyway? Was there another woman? Was he looking at porn? The blinds cast an outlined shadow of his back as Kevin sat at his computer. She was relieved to know he was safe and alone, yet something still didn't feel quite right. "Crystal came to see me because she was anxious, worried, and couldn't sleep. She and Kevin had been married for 23 years. He was a successful real estate broker, disorganized, but faithful to deposit his weekly paycheck into the family's checking account. Kevin's office manager told me she's over his flash-in-the-pan temper and disappearing acts. She can never find him when he's needed." When Crystal asked Kevin why he was working so many hours, he said, "I'm making money. As long as I keep doing that, you need to stay out of my business, literally." Heartbreaking news. A few weeks later, Crystal burst into my office in tears. "I knew it! Kevin's having an affair. I found out he's been seeing a bartender for over 2 years now. She's half his age, and get this, she goes by the name Crystal Glass. Sick. How could he see someone with my name?" Crystal had gone online and found a mugshot of his mistress attached to 3 DUIs. "I can't understand why he'd want to be with someone like that." Looking down, she nervously twisted her diamond wedding band. "My mind is spinning. I keep seeing your face and wondering, how could he do this to me?" Crystal was desperate and told Kevin she'd leave him if they didn't get help. As their anger spilled into one of their counseling sessions, I began to realize that I was hearing more than betrayal and heartache. From my experience working in brain science and trauma, I recognized the telltale signs that their brains were in trouble. They needed more than advice. If we didn't deal with their brain issues, they wouldn't have a chance. I needed to know what was going on under the hood. When the car breaks down, we take it to a trustworthy mechanic for repair. A good mechanic will lift the hood to make sure all the equipment is there. A reputable mechanic will start the car and listen for unfamiliar sounds, diagnosing the deeper, less obvious issues before starting repairs. A mechanic who's worth his salt will do both. Our brains aren't that different, as sometimes their parts need earnest diagnosis and repair, too. Parts is parts. Our brains are a sophisticated communication system made up of fluids, fat, and electrical currents. If our brains aren't working properly, there'll be problems in how we function. Betrayal trauma sets the brain on a crash course that makes it difficult for us to live, breathe, and respond. Some betrayed women find themselves more agitated and reactive, while others freeze or go numb. Our brains are selfishly committed to keeping us alive. They are like an alarm system that stays vigilant against danger. Crystal's brain gasped for air each time she discovered another piece of Kevin's betrayal. She'd been living on edge with her brain running at full speed, making it impossible to rest. "It's torture," she would say. "I can't stop seeing that woman's face. I'm so mad. Kevin keeps telling me it's in the past and I should just calm down." Crystal was relieved when she found out how Kevin's betrayal had impacted her brain. It helped her make sense of the change she saw in herself. When our brains are in overdrive, it's difficult to manage a crisis. Taking time to understand what your brain needs is critical to feeling like yourself again. A picture's worth a thousand words. I've had the privilege of personally working with Dr. Daniel Amen. He's a world-renowned psychiatrist and brain expert who works with complex brains and their symptoms. Dr. Amen uses a process called brain SPECT imaging, which means single photon emission computed tomography, as well as his Amen Brain System checklist to get a better idea of how someone's brain is working. A brain SPECT image looks at three things: which areas of the brain are working well, which areas are working too hard, and which areas are not working hard enough. The SPECT image, along with a detailed history, helps to pinpoint a treatment path in an effort to restore brain function and balance. Throughout this chapter, we'll have a chance to look at some brain SPECT images from two perspectives. But first, let's take a look at your brain. The following questionnaire was created by Dr. Amen to determine how your brain is currently functioning. Our brain systems are intricately connected. If one system is impacted, it can influence the others as well. While some brain researchers separate the systems differently, Dr. Amen's brain system checklist has proved to be a helpful resource. Once you listen to the survey, you'll have a chance to recognize symptoms and ask for help in determining what your brain needs to help it function better. Take time right now to listen to the questionnaire and then think about how you would rate yourself on each of the symptoms. If it's never, give yourself a 0. Rarely, give yourself a 1. Occasionally, make it a 2. Frequently, give yourself a 3. Very frequently, give yourself a 4. If it's not applicable or not known, then don't worry about that. As I go through the questions, find a quiet place where you can think. It'll probably take about 10 or 15 minutes. 1. Failing to give close attention to details or making careless mistakes. 2. Having trouble sustaining attention in routine situations, such as homework, chores, or paperwork. 3. Having trouble listening. 4. Failing to finish things. 5. Having poor organization for time or space, such as a backpack, room, desk, or paperwork. 6. Avoiding, disliking, or being reluctant to engage in tasks that require sustained mental effort. 7. Losing things. 8. Being easily distracted. 9. Being forgetful. 10. Having poor planning skills. 11. Lacking clear goals or forward thinking. 12. Having difficulty expressing feelings. 13. Having difficulty expressing empathy for others. 14. Experiencing excessive daydreaming. 15. Feeling bored. 16. Feeling apathetic or unmotivated. 17, feeling tired, sluggish, or slow moving. 18, feeling spacey or in a fog. 19,